Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Thyroid storm is a rare condition, with less than 2,000 cases diagnosed per year in the U.S. While the disease may be rare, it is a life-threatening disorder that involves severe impairment of organ function and has mortality rates that range between 10 to 30%. This endocrine emergency requires early recognition, aggressive supportive care, and directed pharmacotherapy. Here with us today is Dr. Alex Wantor, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, to review the various pharmacologic agents used in thyroid storm.
Just to piggyback off of what Garrett mentioned with the different agents that we'll be going over today is that a lot of these medications, well, in fact, all of them are used off-label in patients. So just keep that in mind when we're looking at dosing for ranges and different agents that we use as well as we continue through the presentation. So our learning objectives today are to discuss the pharmacological treatment for the reduction of thyroid hormone synthesis. Also, we'll review treatment strategies for acute symptomatic presentation in thyroid storm. And then finally, we'll discuss some of the long-term management practices in patients that present in thyroid storm to prevent its recurrence. To begin, we'll start with a brief review of thyrotoxicosis and hyperthyroidism. Thyrotoxicosis is precipitated from a thyroid or non-thyroid source, and it involves elevated levels of thyroid hormone, which leads to a hypermetabolic state. In patients, this manifests as increases in oxygen consumption, as well as increase in sympathetic nervous system activity for a hyperactive state. Hyperthyroidism is the most common form of thyrotoxicosis. Its rate in the general public is a little over 1%, and there's a higher incidence in women than men at 5 to 1. This also increases with age. On the slide is a brief review of thyroid hormone synthesis. The hypothalamus releases thyroid-releasing hormone, which stimulates the pituitary, which then releases thyroid-stimulating hormone. Thyroid-stimulating hormone then stimulates the thyroid to produce T3, which is triiodothyroxine, and T4, thyroxine. These molecules of T3 and T4 then exert their effects on the tissues. T3 and T4 also exhibit a negative feedback loop on the pituitary and hypothalamus. So as levels of T3 and T4 increase, when this is in a normal state, the levels of TRH and TSH should decrease. Tyrosine and iodide undergo enzymatic processing, which yields thyroxine, T4, and triiodothyroxine, T3. T4 is known as the major circulating hormone and makes up 90% of this. T3 is the minor circulating hormone and makes up roughly 10%. And this is known as the active form of thyroid hormone. On the bottom of the slide, you'll see some reference ranges that I've listed for T4, T3, and TSH. One thing to note with these reference ranges is that these can vary by institution and what is used, and there's no consensus on the exact range of these, but again, these are for your reference. Now we'll begin to discuss some of the signs and symptoms of hyperthyroidism. With elevated levels of thyroid hormone, we see increases in the sympathetic responses. This can manifest as anxiety, diarrhea, heat intolerance, and sweating in patients. Also, palpitations are seen with hyperthyroidism and weakness in patients as well. We'll dive into these a little bit deeper when we discuss thyrotoxicosis and thyroid storm and how these can change. Thyroid storm is the most severe form of thyrotoxicosis. It includes those previous symptoms on the past slide, as well as the addition of decompensation of organ function. This is the hallmark of thyroid storm and what is used to differentiate the two. Its prevalence is fortunately rare and occurs in 1 to 5% of patients that are hospitalized for thyrotoxicosis. And over the past 10 years, there's been less than 2,000 annual cases reported in the United States. Unfortunately, the mortality rate is quite high with thyroid storm and can approach 10 to 30% in patients. Most often, this is caused by decompensated organ function or cardiovascular collapse and also respiratory failure. With thyroid storm, there's almost universally a common underlying diagnosis that puts a patient at risk of having hyperthyroidism. Most commonly, this is untreated Graves' hyperthyroidism, but it can also be toxic multinodular goiter and a toxic adenoma. In addition to this underlying diagnosis, we also need a precipitating event to cause a person to transfer from the thyrotoxicosis to thyroid storm. This can be diabetic ketoacidosis, an infection, surgery, specifically to the thyroid gland, pregnancy, a myocardial infarction, severe trauma, and unfortunately, poor adherence to thyroid, anti-thyroid medications can also cause a patient to enter thyroid storm. Diagnosis of thyroid storm often involves the previous symptoms that I mentioned with hyperthyroidism. Fever is almost universal sign or symptom of a patient in thyroid storm. We also have the addition of sweating and dehydration, tachyarrhythmias, edema, delirium or psychosis, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Again, as you might notice, these are not specific symptoms to thyroid storm and can be seen in many patients that might present to an emergency department. Also, we'll have elevated levels of T4 and T3 with reduced TSH levels. Although with the elevated levels of T4 and T3, the extent of this elevation does not indicate a patient has thyroid storm. We also must consider an underlying insult that might put a patient into a state of thyroid storm. Oftentimes, we must anticipate or determine if a patient is pregnant and to check an ECG to evaluate for a myocardial infarction. Especially with pregnancy, when we discuss the anti-thyroid medications, this will play a role with side effects. When considering the diagnosis of thyroid storm, there is a scoring system that was proposed by Birch and Wartofsky. On this slide, you'll see points that are attributed to various objective and subjective information. A patient's fever and the extent of fever, also tachycardia, whether or not there's a precipitating event, such as pregnancy, trauma, and other events that were listed, also the presence of atrial fibrillation, congestive heart failure and the extent of this congestive heart failure, GI and hepatic dysfunction, and central nervous system disturbances. All of these will play a role in determining a score for a patient to see if there is likelihood that they might be in thyroid storm. This scoring system shows that patients with a score of greater than 45 are highly suggestive of thyrotoxic storm. 25 to 45 is suggestive, and less than 25 is unlikely that a patient is in thyroid storm. Again, when looking at this scoring system, we must evaluate the whole patient, as a patient that is presenting with signs of sepsis might easily score high on this scale, so we need to consider the overall picture of the patient. Now we'll transition into some of the therapies that we use to treat thyroid storm. For all patients, we'll offer supportive care for them, but when we look at the anti-thyroid hormone-directed therapies, we have a three-pronged approach: decreasing thyroid hormone synthesis, decreasing thyroid hormone release, and finally, decreasing the peripheral effects of thyroid hormone. We'll begin with the supportive care in patients. This is often very patient-specific, again, aiming at what that precipitating feature might have been for the patient. We can also apply external cooling measures and use antipyretics such as acetaminophen or NSAIDs to try and treat the fever that they might present with. IV fluids and electrolytes are often necessary in patients as they're in a hypermetabolic state and may be dehydrated. We also need to consider nutritional support in these patients and replete vitamins and thiamine, and also the potential of hypoglycemia, again, as the body is using a lot of energy in this thyroid storm. Also, knowing that respiratory failure is a common cause of death in patients with thyroid storm, we need to consider the need for ventilator support, whether that be invasive or non-invasive. Now we'll transition into the thyroid hormone modifying therapies. This will be the bulk of the conversation and is made up of the five B's. First, we'll look at the blocking of the synthesis of thyroid hormones. Then we'll look at blocking hormonal release. Then beta blockers. Next, we'll look at blocking T4 to T3 conversion, or the major circulating thyroid hormone to the active thyroid hormone. And finally, we'll look at blocking enterohepatic circulation. We'll begin with blocking the synthesis of thyroid hormone. In these patients, we'll use anti-thyroid medications, commonly known as thionamides. These agents should be administered immediately in patients that are in thyroid storm, as they prevent the iodination of tyrosine through thyroid peroxidase enzyme inhibition. We have three main agents that we can use in the United States for the treatment in these patients. First, we'll review propylthiouracil, or PTU, then methimazole, and finally lithium carbonate as an alternative agent. To begin with, propylthiouracil, or PTU, works via two different mechanisms to help reduce thyroid hormone levels. It inhibits thyroid peroxidase, which inhibits thyroid hormone synthesis, and also works to block the conversion of T4 to T3 in the peripheral tissues in patients. This medication is administered orally or via an NG tube with doses of 500 to 1,000 milligrams as a load, followed by 200 to 250 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. Unfortunately, this medication is highly hepatotoxic and needs to be considered in patients that we start and monitoring. Also, this medication is only available as 50 milligram tablets in the United States. And in a patient where we might have a comatose state, there is great difficulty in administering 10 to 20 tablets as a load in these patients and the high burden that these maintenance dosing requires. We can also give PTU as rectally, and there are case reports of administering it IV in patients. However, that is not the ideal route. Preferably, we'll use oral or nasogastric tube administration. Next, we have methimazole, another thionamide that blocks the synthesis of T4 and T3 via blocking the oxidation of iodine in the thyroid gland. This medication is also administered orally or via an NG tube as 20 to 30 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. Again, this medication can also be administered rectally and IV in case reports. However, we need to use caution in pregnancy in patients that we treat with methimazole, and we'll review this in further detail on future slides. Our final agent we can use is lithium carbonate in a dose of 300 milligrams orally every 8 hours. This is an alternative if we cannot use thionamides in patients and is not our preferred agent. It does inhibit the synthesis of T3 and T4 and the release of T3 and T4, but to a lesser extent than our thionamides. It is also limited by toxicities in long-term care of patients and can include a tremor, increased thirst and urination, weight gain, impaired memory, and sexual dysfunction, and also requires serum monitoring. Circling back to pregnancy considerations in patients that we start thionamide therapy in, we have to balance the risks and benefits of these therapies. According to the American Thyroid Association, PTU should be used during the first trimester of pregnancy due to the teratogenic effects of methimazole in patients. Methimazole is recommended during the second and third trimesters. Again, in our patients that present in thyroid storm and who may be pregnant, these very high doses that are seen can cause a significant adverse effects on a pregnant mother and the fetus. Now we'll transition into blocking hormonal release. To block hormonal release, we use iodine therapy. This prevents the additional synthesis of thyroid hormone stores. This may sound counterintuitive, as we know thyroid hormones are made up of iodine. However, via the Wolff-Chaikoff effect, large doses of iodine actually prevent the release of thyroid hormone, and this effect is seen up to 2 weeks after the administration of iodine. We need to administer this therapy at least an hour after a thionamide is used to prevent release of preformed thyroid hormone. We have two agents available for use, saturated solution of potassium iodide, or SSKI, and Lugol's solution. Saturated solution of potassium iodide is dosed as drops in patients and is administered orally or via an NG tube. It's dosed as 5 drops every 6 to 8 hours. This medication is highly concentrated and must be diluted in water, fruit juice, or milk for patients, and contains 50 milligrams of iodine per drop. Our second agent is Lugol's solution and is administered as 5 to 10 drops orally or via an NG tube every 8 hours and also can be diluted in water or milk due to the high concentrations. It contains 6.25 milligrams of iodide per drop. Some considerations with these agents is that they're very high risk. There are many errors that have been reported with prescribing, dispensing, and administrating these medications due to a number of reasons. First, it's dosed as drops rather than milliliters, which is a common unit that we use for administering medications, as drops are often reserved for infants. This leads to misinterpretation in the route of administration as well, and there's case reports of patients and providers instilling these drops into an eye rather than orally, The small vial size can also lead to some confusion for patients when this is dispensed from the inpatient pharmacy as well as outpatient pharmacy, and case reports are present of patients using an entire vial at once as one dose. Also, they contain dangerously high concentrations of potassium and iodine, and there is significant morbidity and cases of mortality associated with the corrosive effects of the high doses of potassium. Finally, Lugol's solution and SSKI are both on the Mayo Clinic critical medication list. The agent stock does vary by location, however. With Mayo Midwest, all sites can stock SSKI except for Northwest Wisconsin, which stocks Lugol's solution. In Florida, they have Iosat tablets, which can be crushed to make a solution of iodine. And in Arizona, according to the Mayo Clinic critical medication list, neither Lugol solution or SSKI are currently stocked. Now we'll begin with our first patient case, a 34-year-old pregnant female with a known history of Graves' hyperthyroidism is admitted to your ICU after she was involved in a motor vehicle accident. She is febrile with a temperature of 39.6, tachycardic with a heart rate of 136, appears jaundiced, and is very lethargic. Her Birch-Wartofsky score is greater than 45, and you have a high suspicion that the patient is in thyroid storm. Which of the following is the most appropriate therapy to initiate for the patient to acutely reduce thyroid hormone production? On the top, if you're using a computer, you can respond using polleverywhere.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx to 22333 once to join, and then your answer. The answers we have are SSKI, 5 drops orally every 6 to 8 hours, propylthiouracil, 500 to 1,000 milligram oral load, followed by 200 to 500 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours, methimazole, 20 to 30 milligrams orally every 4 to 6 hours, and finally, Lugol solution, 5 to 10 drops orally every 8 hours. All right, and the correct answer here is propylthiouracil, 500 to 1,000 milligrams orally as a load, followed by 200 to 250 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. In our patient who was pregnant, we have to use caution for the teratogenic effects of methimazole, but we also need to balance the liver toxicities in PTU. With these high doses of PTU, it is preferred in our patient as they're pregnant, so we would avoid methimazole. SSKI and Lugol solution are both iodine-based therapies, and we would want to administer our thionamide therapy before administering iodine. Therefore, PTU is the correct answer. Now we'll move on to our beta blocker therapy, which is a hallmark of treatment in patients with thyroid storm. These medications should also be administered immediately as they help to block the adrenergic effects of thyroid hormones, therefore decreasing the heart rate. Also, patients that present in a state of heart failure or with arrhythmias, beta blockers are very beneficial. We have a variety of available agents, and the most commonly used and recommended agent is propranolol. It's a preferred agent as it can also reduce serum T3 levels. It's administered IV as 1 to 2 milligrams per minute every 15 minutes or orally 60 to 80 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours. Esmolol is also an agent available for use and is very rapid acting, allowing us to titrate very quickly. It's dosed as 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute and as the initial rate, and is also a preferred therapy in patients that are pregnant. Metoprolol can also be used in patients that may have asthma or COPD as it's cardioselective. And again, it's important to remember with all beta blockers, we will quickly titrate these agents to hemodynamic responses, and the doses may be greater than what we use in other patient populations. Calcium channel blockers can also be used as an alternative, but are not preferred. These will only be used if beta blockers are contraindicated in our patients. An example of a calcium channel blocker that has been used is diltiazem immediate release, 60 to 90 milligrams orally every 6 to 8 hours. But again, calcium channel blockers do not impact circulating or peripheral levels of thyroid hormone like propranolol does. Next, we'll move on to blocking the conversion from T4 to T3. To do this, we will administer IV corticosteroids in patients. These inhibit the peripheral conversion of T4 to T3, and the two agents that are recommended are hydrocortisone at 100 milligrams IV or IM every 6 hours, and dexamethasone 2 milligrams IV every 6 hours. These treatments should be continued while a patient is in thyroid storm, and quickly discontinued or tapered if necessary if it is used long term, But again, once the thyroid storm has resolved, we will often discontinue this treatment. Our final agent that we will review and mechanism is blocking enterohepatic circulation. To block enterohepatic circulation, we'll use cholestyramine 4 grams orally, 2 to 4 times daily. Cholestyramine decreases the reabsorption of metabolized thyroid hormone from enterohepatic circulation, as it's a bile acid sequestrant, and thyroid hormone, it can be recycled in the enterohepatic circulation. Therefore, this gives us another mechanism to potentially block and decrease levels of thyroid hormone. Now we'll move on to the second patient case. A 67-year-old male is admitted with a toxic adenoma in a state of thyroid storm. He has already been started on methimazole, 20 milligrams, every 6 hours. He remains tachycardic, lethargic, and is sweating profusely. You'd like to administer additional agents to treat the patient. When considering therapy options, which of the following medications used in the treatment of thyroid storm does not have the added benefit of reducing circulating or peripheral levels of thyroid hormone? Is it A, hydrocortisone, B, propranolol, C, diltiazem, or D, cholestyramine? For question 2, the correct answer is diltiazem. Calcium channel blockers do not have the added benefit of decreasing circulating or peripheral levels of thyroid hormone. Hydrocortisone decreases the conversion of T4 to T3 in peripheral tissues. Propranolol can decrease circulating levels of T3. And cholestyramine can bind thyroid hormone in enterohepatic circulation. Therefore, diltiazem is the correct answer. Now we'll transition into some additional factors in the diagnosis and treatment of patients with thyroid storm. It is often overreported in the emergency department due to patients' presentation and misinterpretation of elevated T3 and T4 levels that cause concern. It's recommended to approach similarly to a patient with hypertensive urgency versus emergency, where the differentiation is end organ damage in patients, which dictates the treatment. Also, we need to treat the precipitating illness as well, as this can be just as deadly in patients that may present in DKA or with an MI, infection, and etc. Also, improvement is rapidly seen in patients that are treated promptly, with resolution of thyroid storm occurring within 24 to 72 hours in most patients. Regarding therapies that are started for patients in thyroid storm, we like to discontinue corticosteroids and iodine therapy as soon as able. However, for our thionamides and beta blockers, these therapies will often be continued at discharge. Thionamides are continued with the goal of euthyroidism in patients, and beta blockers can help with the symptomatic management and are again titrated in patients. Now we'll review some of the long-term management options in patients, namely antithyroid medications, thyroidectomy, and radioactive iodine. Antithyroid medications, our thionamides that are started at admission, are often continued in patients and help to rapidly achieve euthyroidism. Unfortunately, with this treatment option, adherence limits the efficacy, and if patients stop taking their thionamide, can also cause them to return to a state of thyrotoxicosis or thyroid storm. Our treatment options are methimazole in a wide range of dosing of 5 to 60 milligrams daily in divided doses, or propylthiouracil 50 to 150 milligrams 3 times daily. Again, methimazole is our preferred agent, as propylthiouracil has an FDA advisory on liver toxicity. For monitoring, these require monthly thyroid function tests and baseline CBC and LFTs. A thyroidectomy is another option for treatment of patients. This is often used in patients who may be allergic to thionamides or who have a goiter or tumor. They're often pre-treated with a thionamide prior to surgery as well to decrease the risk of thyrotoxicosis or thyroid storm during thyroidectomy. In patients where there is a total thyroidectomy done, we'll often start therapy of levothyroxine at a dose of 1.6 micrograms per kilogram daily in patients. Our last treatment choice that we have is radioactive iodine. This requires euthyroidism prior to therapy, and the thionamide is continued up until 2 to 3 days before starting radioactive iodine therapy. It's administered orally as a capsule or solution, and is also individualized as a patient-specific dosing. It can result in thyroid ablation within 6 to 18 weeks in patients, and the goal of therapy is often a hypothyroid state, which may require supplementation with levothyroxine. Radioactive iodine treatment is one of the preferred choices in the United States for patients with thyrotoxicosis or thyroid storm. However, it does require precautionary measures in patients to start this therapy as they're taking a radioactive medication. Most of the radioactive iodine is localized to the thyroid gland when starting therapy. However, extra caution needs to be taken, such as double flushing the toilet after going to the bathroom, and reduced close contact with children and sexual contact as well. Also, patients are advised to avoid pregnancy while taking this therapy. Our final question, we have our patient from the previous case who is now discharged from the hospital after resolution of thyroid storm. He's scheduled to have a thyroidectomy in 1 month. Which agent is the least appropriate for the patient to continue at discharge? Is it A, methimazole 10 milligrams twice daily, propranolol 80 milligrams twice daily, or prednisone 20 milligrams daily? The correct answer is C, prednisone 20 milligrams daily. Steroid therapy is started immediately in patients to help reduce the conversion of T4 to T3 in peripheral tissues, however, is not necessary for long-term treatment in patients. Methimazole is often continued in patients with the goal of euthyroidism, and propranolol, 80 milligrams twice daily, could be used to decrease the sympathetic side effects that a patient may have with hyperthyroidism. In summary, we have five different mechanisms we can use to treat patients for pharmacotherapy, and includes blocking the synthesis of thyroid hormone, using methimazole, propylthiouracil, and lithium as an alternative agent. We also can block the release of thyroid hormone using Lugol's solution or saturated solution of potassium iodide. In addition, we also use beta blocker therapy, with propranolol being our preferred agent, as it not only reduces the sympathetic effects of thyroid hormone, but can also reduce circulating levels of T3. Metoprolol and esmolol are beta blockers that are often used as well, and diltiazem, a calcium channel blocker, can be used as an alternative if beta blockers are contraindicated. We can also target blocking the conversion of thyroid hormone from T4 to T3 using steroid therapy of dexamethasone and hydrocortisone. And finally, we can block the circulation of thyroid hormone through enterohepatic circulation using cholestyramine. Our long-term management of patients, we have three different options. Antithyroid medications can be continued at when a patient is discharged. However, this therapy can be limited by patient adherence. Thyroidectomy is also commonly used in patients that may have a goiter or tumor of the thyroid gland and often will require supplemental doses of levothyroxine. Finally, radioactive iodine is also a safe and often used therapy to achieve euthyroidism in patients.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.